You know, Lord, as we've been going through Genesis here, you've confronted us with things that we may not have known before, with things that we may not have believed before, and yet this is what's coming directly to us from your word. And tonight, God, I know that you, as we get into these passages, will once again be confronted with truth that is startling and that calls us out from where we are. We pray that we'll have the courage to face that, God, and to let it penetrate our hearts. In Christ's name, amen. All right, tonight we're going to be using biography in the book of Genesis to study a little bit of comparison between what I call radical versus convenient faith. Convenient faith means a faith that doesn't disturb any of my other priorities and basically leaves me free to pursue whatever. Doesn't really interfere with my plans. Radical faith is a faith that's completely disruptive and which absolutely calls the tune in my life. Two different approaches to faith in God. Abraham and Lot are the two guys we're going to compare on this. When you think about it, not everyone who follows God has the same experience. Some people that follow God seem to mature spiritually. Their lives change in a magnificent way. They go on to a life that's full of fruit, impacts other people all around. They're able to get married successfully. They're able to have families that are well-adjusted. Their lives are just blessed by God. And they have their problems as well as anyone else. It's just a general sense of victory there in life. But you see other people, including authentic Christian believers, who just don't seem to go that way. And as a matter of fact, their life seems to be full of a lot of misery, a lot of the same kind of problems and conflict that you see with people that don't know God at all. So just because we accept the gift of forgiveness from God doesn't mean that we necessarily are going to grow spiritually with Him. Now, in Abraham and his nephew named Lot, here are a couple of guys who both believed in God, and apparently they believed in Him to the extent that it was good enough for them to be forgiven. They're both referred to as righteous in the sense of imputed righteousness. God reckoned them to be righteous. On the other hand, these two guys form a striking contrast, which is really the contrast between victory and defeat in this life. Sure, maybe they both went to heaven, but what they went through in this life was night and day. And that's probably a pretty good lesson that we can learn from this. Let's start out going back and thinking a little more about Abraham, who we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. Remember the calling of Abraham that we studied in Genesis chapter 12? God came to him in Ur, and he said, "Leave your country, your relatives, your father's house, and go to the land I will show you, and I'll make you into a great nation, and I will bless you." And so if you look closely, he says, first of all, leave your country, that is to say, soil, you know, my homeland. That's pretty important to a lot of people, especially in the ancient world, more so than today with our mobility. People put roots into the ground. Also, leave your relatives, i.e. blood. Blood and soil, probably two of the most important things to people on earth then and now. And he says, leave those things. And then two, leave your father's house. And here was where you get your inheritance. You know, they would inherit the dad's estate, and apparently Abraham's dad had a lot of money. So here's money. Blood, soil, and money. According to the wisdom of the world, those things rank at the very top of what matters in life. And God's coming to this guy, and he's saying, leave everything, leave all those things, and come follow me. And he gives him a pretty vague statement, you know, I'm going to turn you into a nation and I'll bless you. But if I, you know, if a lot of us were Abraham, we'd probably be like, yeah, what kind of blessing? Now let's hear a little bit more. This is a complete departure from his comfort zone in life. Everything that Abraham had built up for himself, everything that his identity, people draw their identity from these things, and God's saying, leave all of that. So it's a very radical call, and the real radical part is that Abraham did it. Radical trust. He left his comfort zone, and what did he leave it for? basically the promise of God that he would be blessed. But what actually happened? We read that he was called to go to a place. This is some commentary on this in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament. It says, when he was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. And I've thought about that a lot. You know, it'd be really hard to leave your blood, your soil, and all of your money, especially if you're wealthy like they were, but to leave it not knowing for what? That's extreme. And yet following God is this way. This is the kind of thing that God will put on someone who says, I want to get down and get serious with you. As a matter of fact, God often calls us to follow him, and he does not disclose what that entails. But he just wants to know, yes or no. And he basically, it's like signing a blank check and handing it to God. No questions asked. That's radical trust. Well, why does God do this? That's worth thinking about. When God calls us to follow without giving us the destination, one of the reasons for this is because our desire to know the destination and to know the future is morbid and it's controlling. Why do we feel like we need to know, wait a minute, follow me where? What does this mean, this blessing? We want God to unfold that and explain it to us a little bit more. Why? So we can see whether it's good enough. So we can pass a judgment on, you know, it's like, first show me what's entailed, then I'll decide. In other words, I'm still the one running the ship. I'm still the one making the judgments and weighing the advantages and benefits. In fact, I'm not following at all. When you follow someone, they decide where you're going to go, not you. And God sees through the veneer of you know, pseudo-faith, pseudo-following very clearly. And that's why he smokes that out a lot of times by calling on us to follow him and with not telling us where it's leading. Because the only thing we have to go on then is not how good is this going to be when I get to this destination, but rather, do I trust this guy or not? Do I trust God enough to follow him? Would he lead me to a bad place? No, he's not that kind of God. He's good. He loves me. I can trust him. So I'm going. And that's the way Abraham was. So, to put it on differently, the only reason that we think we have to know the future is because we don't trust God enough to leave that in his hands. And I think this is a real common problem that a lot of us have. If you have any anxiety in your life, any restlessness, it's usually attached to this. It's like, you know, God, are you going to let me marry somebody that's really hot? You know, and we have all of these questions that we worry about, and it's all around this general area here. The more we distrust God, the more our anxiety level rises, and the less sure we are that just following him will be good enough. The one who says then that he's going to follow God but insists on knowing where he's going is contradicting himself. He's saying that he's following, but he really wants to lead. And this question then finds us out. Are we willing to follow God without this contingency? Without putting down any contingencies on, I'll follow you if. No ifs, ands, or buts. Just, I'm ready to follow. Period. That's what real trust in God is. That's what radical trust in God is. And the outcome was not a short time of suspense with a big blessing waiting at the end. Okay, that's not the way it went down. Check out Hebrews 11. Notice that he followed in order to receive a blessing that he would later receive. Turns out it was much later. Later than anyone would have guessed. And a lot of what's involved in following God is not getting the instant gratification that fires our society up, but is living for more distant values that are more off in the future. They're as real as can be. It's not like they're fictitious values. These are real values. They're incredible value, but they don't come for some time. We read on in Hebrews 11 that by faith he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. As a matter of fact, he lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. Throughout his long life, Abraham never did get given to him this country that God said, I'm going to bestow this country on you and your kids. His son Isaac didn't get it either, neither did his grandson Jacob. And you're talking about a span here of 150 years and more, and still no answer in sight. So these people who are people of faith live believing God for something that's going to be way off in the future, maybe in the next life even. And for people that know God, who believe in the reality of the spiritual, that which happens to us after this life is pretty important. And we're willing to make forfeitures now for the sake of that. Hebrews 11 says all these people, Abraham and some others he mentioned, were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. Not in this life. No. God did eventually give the land to Abraham's descendants. He kept his promise, but not to Abraham. When Abraham's wife died, he had to go buy a piece of property to bury her in. He didn't own any. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they were admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. This is really what the life of faith is. Now, some people lose heart at this point, and they're just like, well, I don't know if I'm into that. You know, I mean, I feel like there has to be some fruit, some results here and now. And, you know, there are. There certainly is a deep-seated satisfaction and comfort in the knowledge that I'm in there with God and that I'm following Him. But as far as tangible outward rewards, not necessarily. Often not, as a matter of fact. If you want to live and try to feed the self with immediate tangible rewards, following God is not what you're after. That's not the way to do it. Lot will show us that path. This path described by Abraham is a pathway that often leads us on the outside as far as the world system is concerned. And we accept that readily. You notice he says they admitted they were aliens and strangers on earth. Well, that word, by the way, aliens, is the plural xenoi for the Greek word xenos. And, that's, according to the Bible, that's our identity. We're passing through this life. We're here temporarily. This is not our identity, this culture, the fashions, the popular movements of our day. That's not what we're about. We're strangers to that. And we pass through because we're on course for something much more important. That's what it means to be an alien and a stranger in the world. A lot of people get turned off by this. They're like, I don't want to be an alien. I don't want to be an outsider. Well, the problem is that we only have really two choices. On the one hand, we can be aliens from God and at home in the world system. Or on the other hand, we can be at home with God and aliens in the world system. Repeatedly, God stresses this point that you need to make a decision about what you're going to base your life on. Is it going to be on me, or is it going to be on the dictates of the world system of the culture of which you're a part? Watchman Nee says, when the soul becomes our life, we live as aliens and fugitives from God. He uses the term soul as the self-life. When we start living for self, when we're living the life that's not the life of trust, then he says we live as aliens and fugitives from God. And this, he's speaking not in terms of people who are not believers in God, but rather he's saying actual, authentic believers in God may end up living their lives, much of it, as aliens and fugitives from God, because they've set a path based on the self and self-aggrandizement, self-satisfaction, that's at odds with God's purposes in our lives. Well, let's compare Abraham, the radical believer in God, with Lot, his nephew. The story starts in chapter 13, where we read that Lot, who was moving about with Abraham, also had flocks and herds and tents. But the land could not support them while they stayed together because their possessions were so great they weren't able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abraham's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. So Abraham said to Lot, let's not have any quarreling between you and me or between our herdsmen, your herdsmen and mine, because we're brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. So here's a peaceful proposition. Some of these highlands they were hanging out in are pretty sparse. They don't have a lot of fodder growing on them. And so he's like, we need to spread out here. Well, Lot looked up and saw the whole plain of the Jordan River. It was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt towards Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And so they're standing up here, and Abraham gives Lot the choice. Here are these highlands that we're on, these mountain range, with its sparse growth. And then over here, look at that valley, man. Full of green, you know, I mean, there's a river down there and tributaries and stuff. It's all well-watered, great agricultural land. And so Lot's like, well, Abraham, I'll let you have the well-watered part, right? Oh, no. Because Lot is a guy who's basically looking for self-interest. And he immediately seizes and says, I'll take that right there. And so it's kind of a window into his value system, what matters to him. I mean, at the very least, you could say, well, maybe we could just like trade, you know. You take 6 months down in the good part, and then I'll go six or whatever. No, that's not his interest. I'm getting the good for me. Well, it's a subtle thing, but of course, down in that valley are Sodom and Gomorrah, and he gets tangled up with them, as we'll see. But before we leave this verse, I just want to diverge for a minute with a brief critical note. Okay, a lot of you guys have taken Bible as literature at Ohio State, Columbus State, and you've learned that modern scholars like to say that this whole account in Genesis was not written by Moses at all, as it claims to be, 1400 B.C., but Riley was put into writing not earlier than 750 B.C. and maybe 650 B.C. So it's really first millennium. And these are tribal lore and folklore of the people of Israel told around campfires, and someone finally wrote it down. And then it was redacted subsequent to that, and down as late as 400 B.C. So they late date the final composition of Genesis being conflated and redacted down as late as 500 or 400 B.C., 1,000 years after it says that it was written. Now, I want you to just think about this verse in connection with that proposition, because I don't believe that. I believe with a lot of scholars, scholarship is certainly not united on this point by any means. They disagree with each other, but I side with the scholarship that would hold that actually this was written by Moses and is extremely ancient, 1400 B.C. composition. Written at a time when the Jewish people were getting out of Egypt and were wandering in the wilderness on their way up to the land of Israel. Now, here's an interesting thing to think about. This is a map of Israel. And encircled in white is the Jordan Valley. If you ever go to Israel, you realize that this Jordan Valley is very impressive. It's immense. This is actually a rift valley that is deep and wide. It dominates the geography of Israel. This country is very narrow. If you cut Indiana in half from top to bottom, one half of Indiana would almost be identical to the size of Israel. It's not a big country. On either side of the valley of the Jordan are a range of hills and mountains, so that from most of the country, literally, you can see the Jordan Valley as you look down into this immense valley. It's inconceivable that anyone could live in the country of Israel and not know what the Jordan Valley is, since it's the most prominent aspect of that country. And yet, here is the author of Genesis, saying to his readers, the Jordan Valley, okay, is this place, it's well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you're going up towards Zoar. Now just think about that. Isn't it clear that this was written not to people who lived in Israel whatsoever? But actually to people who have never been to Israel, like the children of Israel in the time of Moses. These were people who have been slaves in Egypt. He's describing Israel to them. Moses has been there, but none of the rest of them have ever been there before. And he's saying, well, you know, it's a big valley and well-watered. It's kind of like down in Egypt as you're headed up towards Zoar. It's like that. Oh, yeah, you can see how obvious that is. And someone could well say, well, maybe someone just inserted this later, you know, to make it seem like the document was written to an Egyptian audience rather than to an Israeli audience. Yeah, that's unthinkable, okay? To believe in that, then the author, this ancient author, would have to anticipate that in the modern era, 3,000-4,000 years after his time, people would come to doubt the date of composition of his book. And anticipating that, he would have to think to himself, I'll just mislead him and make him think it's written by Moses by putting this in. The Mosaic authorship of Genesis was never questioned until modernity hit. And so that is an unthinkable thought, that anyone could anticipate that or do anything about it. It's very obvious to me that this book is using something they did know, Egypt, as you're headed towards Zoar, to explain something they did not know, the Jordan Valley, which every person in Israel would know. Well, it's just one verse, but there are many others like it. And I think that's more powerful than any 100 opinions, subjective opinions about the literary style of this book. Anyway, Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan. And so he goes for it, and he sets out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abraham lived in a land of Canaan up in the hills, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Well, after a while, he kind of got into the Sodom way of life, so he moved into the city later. Now, the men of Sodom, were warned, were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. This city is described as one of the most evil cities in the ancient world. We know from this area that human sacrifice was commonplace. These were slaveholding societies. We read in other places in the Old Testament that Sodom was a bitter oppressor of the poor. So it's violent, it's oppressive, and rampant sexual immorality as a way of life, as we shall see. Well, we're going to move ahead a few chapters. We leave Lot down in Sodom. And the next thing you know, Abraham's up in the mountains and three guys come by. And it turns out they're angels. One of them is the angel of the Lord. It's God coming to speak to him. And they have dinner with him and the two other guys walk off to Sodom. They're going to take it out. God's basically had it with Sodom. He says, I'm going to waste that city. They've crossed a line. And as they leave, the last one, the angel of the Lord, says, should I hide my plan from Abraham? The Lord asked. And so God told Abraham, I've heard that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are extremely evil and that everything they do is wicked. And so he's basically announces, I'm going to judge. I'm going to pass judgment against this city and destroy it. Well, Abraham approaches him and they have this real funny conversation. He says, will you destroy both the innocent and the guilty alike? Suppose you find 50 innocent people there within the city. You wouldn't still destroy it and not spare it for their sakes? Surely you wouldn't do such a thing, destroying the innocent with the guilty. Why, you'd be treating the innocent and the guilty the same way. That's unfair. One of the attributes of God is justice, that he will match his actions to what is just and fair. The Lord said, well, if I find 50 innocent people in Sodom, I'll spare the entire city just for their sake. Old Abraham isn't done. He says, okay, since I've begun, let me go on and speak a little further to my Lord, even though I'm just but dust and ashes. Suppose there's only 45. Would you destroy the city just because they're missing 5 innocent people? The Lord's like, I would not destroy it even if I found only 45. And Abraham's like, pressing his request further. Okay, well, suppose there's only 40. And the Lord's replied, I wouldn't destroy it even if there were only 40 in there. And he says, well, don't be angry, my Lord, but let me just speak. Suppose there's only 30 found there. Dickering him down, man. And God's like, even if there's only 30, I will not destroy this. I'll spare that whole city just because there's 30 people in there that are following me. And Abraham decides to take the plunge. Okay, since I've dared to speak to the Lord, let me continue. Suppose there's only 20. And the Lord said, then I wouldn't destroy it even if there were only 20. And finally, he can't resist. He says, all right, don't get angry. I'm just going to speak one more time. Suppose there's only 10 found in the whole city that are followers of yours. And God said, then for the sake of the 10, I will not destroy it. So he worked him from 50 all the way down to 10 people. If there's just 10 believers down in that city, God says, I'll spare the entire city. Raunchy as it is, awful as it is, if there's 10 believers there, I'll leave it alone. And so this narrative is basically showing us God's reluctance to judge people. Not that he won't judge people. If we can believe the Bible, God is prepared to judge. There is a judgment day. And it may come earlier for some than others. In this case of Sodom and Gomorrah, the judgment day was now at hand. And yet you see an overwhelming concern on God's part for anyone that wants to follow him. He doesn't want them to come under judgment. Well, in 19 then, we read the other two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. That's where the elders would sit. See, he's like one of the influential guys in town by now. He's really in the swing of Sodomic life. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. He must have sensed these guys work with God. My lords, he said, please turn aside to your servant's house. He takes them home. Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every quarter of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called out to Lot, where are those men that came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them. They're going to rape these guys. It's a savage. And it sounds like the men and even the boys were out there. You know, you can just see it. Daddy, it's my turn. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what's going on here. Lot went outside to meet them. This gives us an idea of what life was like in this city. And he shut the door behind him. He says, no, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters. You've never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do whatever you like with them. But don't do anything to these men. Oh, that's real good. That's great, Lot. So, Dad, thanks. This gives you a sense of the how this guy's, you know, moral perspective has just slid pitifully. This is an incredible act of treachery toward his daughters. The men shouted out, stand back! Who do you think you are? We let you settle among us and now you're trying to tell us what to do. We'll treat you worse than the other men. And they lunged at Lot and began breaking down the door. Mob action. But the two angels reached out and pulled Lot in and bolted the door. And then they blinded the men of Sodom so they couldn't find a doorway. These guys were groping around. What happened? What happened? Well, I'm sure this whole account is just given to us to give us a feeling for what it was like down there. That this was a moral climate of such darkness and filth that God had it with them. And he wasn't going to put up with it anymore. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away with the city when it's punished. But when he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. It's interesting that God's focus is still on rescuing anyone that wants to follow him, even though these guys are barely following him. You know, I mean, here you there. He knows by now that these guys work for God. They just struck a mob of people blind. You can see their supernatural power. And they're telling him, look, God's going to move in on this city, and if you're here, you're going to die. You better get out of here right now. And he's like, oh, man, I don't know. I got some stuff here. I mean, what am I, you know, I mean, I don't know, man. And he won't go. He won't go. They had to literally take him by the hand and drag him out of the city. Run for your lives, they told him. Don't stop anywhere in the valley and don't look back, especially to escape to the mountains or you'll die. Oh, no, my Lord, please, Lot begged. He says, you've been so kind to me and you saved my life and all, and you've granted me such mercy, but I can't go to the mountains. Disaster would catch up to me there and I would soon die. Well, that's a bizarre claim, especially since we see him later in the book living back in the mountains again. So, you know, I don't know, but he's probably trying to stay close to his stuff. He says, look, here's a small village nearby. Just let me go there instead. I mean, don't look how small it is. And then my life will be saved. Well, they're tired of arguing with him. And all right, we'll grant your request. I won't destroy that village. But hurry, because I can't do anything until you're there. And from that time on, the village was known as Zoar, which is a word having to do with little. The sun was rising as Lot reached the village. Well, the Lord then rained down fire and burning sulfur from the heavens on Sodom and Gomorrah. He utterly destroyed them along with the other cities and villages of the plain, eliminating all life, people, plants, and animals alike. But Lot's wife looks back at Sodom as he's following along behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Judgment from God. They told her not to do that. I suppose, metaphorically, looking back at Sodom with longing, probably, wishing she was still there. I don't know. I mean, yeah. So here we go with the mythology, all right? Fire and brimstone coming out of heaven, burning cities down and stuff like this. Totally wild story, totally not believable. Well, before we go too far down that path, let's stop and think about this, okay? I'm pretty old, and I remember being a Christian believer and reading Bible commentaries that scoffed at the whole idea that such a thing as Sodom and Gomorrah ever existed. They argued that these are metaphorical towns that stand for the principle of human evil, that, you know, they've never been discovered. And in fact, today we know that the most likely location for Sodom and Gomorrah are underneath the northern end of the Dead Sea, which had a lower sea level at that time. So they're not accessible to exploration. But that's believed to be where they are today. For people who are foolish enough and naive enough to believe in a Sodom or a Gomorrah, or any aspect of this story, that it's anything other than just pure folklore. Or is it? The world then was shocked when the excavations at Tel Ebla, which is also called Tel Mardik, in Syria, unearthed tablets from 2300 BC referring to Sodom and Gomorrah, actual sales receipts from the city of Sodom in the cache of tablets that they dug up there. Today, you won't find scholars denying the existence of Sodom or Gomorrah anymore. And yet, no reference to either of these cities had existed during the centuries after their destruction because they weren't there anymore. So nobody was doing business with them. And that's why it was possible for people to say, well, if there was a Sodom and Gomorrah, we would certainly know about it because there'd be, you know, remains and references to those cities in other towns that we've excavated and so forth. And there weren't any. And then we go back even further and excavated Tel Ebla, one of the really ancient tells in the Near East, and find multiple references to both of these cities there. Obviously, they did exist at one time. And that kind of makes you think about the whole account, doesn't it? I suppose it's really possible that this actually happened. I wouldn't be too happy about it. I think it's a scary story, but you know, if God's going to judge, then He's going to judge. And there's nothing any of us can do about that. And the Bible declares that God is the kind of God who is very loving, but He's also just. And there is a limit And he will judge humans who are guilty. In 19, it goes on to talk about the end of Lot's life. And it says, Lot and his two daughters, the wife now dead, left Zoar and eventually settled in the mountains. Hey, I thought she said he was going to die if he went to the mountains. Let's see. He and his two daughters lived up there in a cave. So he's fallen terribly now from being one of the elders of Sodom, a rich man. And now he's hidden in a cave with his two daughters. One day the older daughter says to the younger, our father's old, and there's no man around here to lie with us, as is the custom all over the earth. Let's get our father drunk with wine and then lie with him and preserve our family line through our father. That night they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went in and lay with him. He was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. Well, boy, that's a drunk there. He must have been really liquored. The next night, the older daughter said to the younger, last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight, and you go in and lie with him so we can preserve our family line through our father. So they got their father to drink wine that night also, and the younger daughter went in and lay with him. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. Savage. When the older daughter gave birth to a son, she named him Moab, and he became the ancestor of the nation now known as the Moabites. When the younger daughter gave birth to a son, she named him Ben-Ammi, and he became the ancestor of the nation now known as the Ammonites. Two historical adversaries of Israel, these two nations. And this is how they came into being. Well, oh my God, this story is so gross. And, you know, I mean, this is just family life there in the family of Lot. Lot's life, it's pitiful. This is a bitter tale of utter spiritual defeat. I mean, there's just almost nothing good to relate about the whole career of Lot. Lot thought he had it all together. You know, he went for the money. He went for the well-watered plain. He got in with the people in Sodom, big happening town at that time. So it seemed like he had it all together. And yet, you know, obviously he had nothing together spiritually. His value system was selfish. It was materialistic, focused on getting money for himself. And it was liberal, too, in the sense that 2 Peter says that Lot's righteous soul was vexed every day by what he saw going on in the lawless, incredibly anarchistic city he lived in. And yet, obviously, he didn't take any kind of stand about it. Because, you know, he's in there calling, they're his dear friends, and he's in the city gates with them and everything else. I mean, he just fit in. And so it was just sort of like live and let live. He obviously had no impact, none, on this city. Because he's just like, well, you know, I guess maybe we shouldn't rape people like they do, but whatever floats your boat. He wasn't able to draw a line between his intended level of application and the level of application that actually was applied by his family. I mean, Lot probably would have been aghast if he thought that his daughters would do something like this. But the thing is, he had shown them the way. Disregard for God's way in life. And he only wanted to take it part way. He just wanted compromise. But his family took it to its logical conclusion. And there was nothing he could do about it. Nobody would have listened to him anyway. Uncommitted faith. Lot's life stands in stark contrast, then, to Abraham's when you really put it all together. Lot followed a way of life that delivered rewards immediately. He went for the money, for the prestige of the city, those kind of things. Abraham lived his life following a way that depended on God to reward him later. Lot thought he could get away with living on the bare fringe of what God wanted. He's definitely a believer. He's referred to that way. But he's trying to do the least he can to deal with God. Abraham, on the other hand, instead of looking for ways around God's will, he sought out how to follow him more. And as we'll see next week, this went to an amazing extreme. Lot was unable to lead his family or anyone else in Sodom or anywhere with his passive hedonism. He was just having a good time, just trying to enjoy himself in life. And of course, There's nothing to attract anyone to that. There is no example to follow there. It's just c'est la vie, whatever, and let life happen. Whereas Abraham, his family wasn't without problems, as we talked about last week, but they did basically adopt his value system and carried on the faith of their dad. Lot's life ended in a catastrophic and miserable state of disintegration and sin. I don't know what kind of story you could tell that would be worse than this description of his family at the end. Abraham, his life ended as one of the most impactful and important lives ever lived. As we pointed out last week, how is it that half the population of the earth today draw their spiritual lineage back to this guy, this unknown Hebrew living 4,000 years ago, and he's still impacting the world today? So Lot really stands for what happens when our aim is to draw lines with God based on our distrust of Him. We don't trust God to show us the way to live. And so we try to draw lines and try to give the least we can, you know, and just stay out of trouble. Whereas Abraham stands as an example of how radical trust leads to eternal impact for God, a life that matters during your life and for all eternity thereafter. And these are the two paradigms that are put in front of us here. There's a lot to think about here. And believe me, if you're following God, then I think this choice is going to confront you squarely sooner or later in your life. I thought it was an interesting story, one of our own, who faced a question like this not too long ago. And I asked her if she would share it with us. Her name's Mindy.
I was going to Miami University. I was studying music. I got involved in a lot of ensembles. I really was interested in world music. I got to go to India and study world music there, and I was planning on going to Africa too and things like that later on. So I guess I was living in Oxford and just trying to seriously kick some butt, you know what I mean, like in the music field. I was really excited about a lot of things. I was making a lot of really good connections all over the country and a little bit in the world too. My professors were from mostly like Eastern Asia and Africa. But I was really excited because it was like I wanted to go travel, I wanted to play music in other countries, and I was getting all these opportunities like to do that. So I encountered a lot of different views of my own, a lot of postmodernism, a lot of people saying that, well, yeah, Christianity is cool, but everything else is cool too. And I didn't really know why that wasn't an okay idea, and I couldn't really defend my faith a lot. I had a lot of people who really hated Christians because there's a lot of weird Christians down there. And so I always found myself trying to defend myself but not really having anything solid to go with. And so my faith started to really wane. I kind of stopped thinking that Christianity was probably the only way. I didn't really care what the Bible had to say. It seemed too complicated and messy to try to figure out if that really was God's word. And basically, it got down to the point where I wasn't even really sure that God existed anymore. I was dating this guy for the whole time I was in college. He is agnostic. I think that probably the biggest point then, spiritually, for me, was when this guy I'd been dating for 2 years decided he was in love with someone else. And at that point, I had kind of exchanged love for God. So it was like, love was my God. I thought that, like, that, you know, this true love existed and that was what righted all wrongs and made you happy and just was like the most incredible thing. You know, I really believed in love, and I thought that I had it with this guy. And when he decided that he was in love with someone else, it didn't match up with what I thought love was, and it just completely screwed up my mind. And I was so confused. My life came to a standstill. I couldn't do any of the stuff at school that I was working on, like all the music stuff I was involved in, I couldn't do. And my grades went down really bad, and I finally came to this point spiritually where I called out to God. I kind of fell on the floor. I was weeping. And I told him that he needed to, if he was even there, that he needed to kill me or give me a reason to live because I didn't have one. And I really didn't believe that there would be one. I really saw life. It was very futile. The only thing I had believed in at that point was love, and it failed. So I was ready. I really was ready to die. But I didn't make any action to actually kill myself because I wanted to give whatever God there was an opportunity to answer. But when this stuff had happened with me, with kind of calling out to God and asking Him to give me a purpose to live and stuff like that, my brother called me. And he, again, was asking me if I wanted to come out to one of his, like, church Bible functions or whatever. And it was a retreat at my grandparents' cabin. And he asked me if I wanted to come. And I was, like, really, really hesitant. I told him, you know, I don't want to be around Christians. They're going to tell me that the reason why I am suffering so much is because I made all these bad choices. And I just can't handle that, you know. I think it's bull, and I don't want to hear it. I was really lonely, you know. I mean, I had been living with this guy, and since he had left, he moved out. I had this whole apartment to myself. So I went, and I was really closed off. First, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to pretend like I was happy. I didn't want people to think I was happy, but I didn't really want to talk to anybody, and I didn't want to get the superficial Christianity that I had in church while I was growing up. They had a teaching that night. Ryan Lauer was teaching, and he taught on how to be a disciple of Christ. I just started weeping while he was teaching. I was so, you know, just like struck. I was really, really stunned. And I, you know, thanked God that he hadn't abandoned me, because I felt like this was the beginning of that answer to prayer, where he was saying, you want a purpose to live? Here's how to be a disciple of Christ. Here's how you can live your whole life for me. That night I prayed and I thanked him for not abandoning me when I had, you know, decided he wasn't there anymore. And so by the time the retreat was over, I was a completely changed person. It was like, one minute I was ready to in my life, and the next minute I knew that God was real. I knew there was a way that I could live that was a very purposeful life, and that actually it would be the best life that I could ever live, much better than anything I'd ever imagined. This started thinking about how there was nothing like those kind of meetings, like those Bible studies in Miami. I hadn't ever been to anything like that. So I started thinking that maybe I should commute, because I had my own apartment. I was in a lease for the next year, actually. And this was like in April at the end of my sophomore year, but I had a lease for the whole next year. I started commuting once or twice a week. And a lot of the girls there who I had just met for the first time, like, you know, a month or two ago, were all like, you know, you really should just move to Columbus. And I was thinking, you know, these guys don't understand. I can't just move to Columbus. I've got an apartment, you know, I've got a whole life that I've built up. Because now that I was starting to get back on my feet, I saw a lot of the positive things that I had in my life. I knew that what was going on in my life, because I was around people who were radically committed to God, and because I was on a regular basis getting to totally, like, indulge myself with the word for the first time in my life, I knew that I wasn't going to get that anywhere at Miami. But I also couldn't imagine leaving everything that I had built up. Like, it was just so exciting to be there, you know what I mean? And there's so many really cool things going on. It was Division I wanted to play basketball, you know what I mean? Things like that. I just hated the idea of not being there and stuff. And I knew that, like, I'd maybe transfer to OSU, and I never really wanted to go to school at OSU, although I liked Buckeyes. So I always would shove it up, like, they just don't understand how much I would have to leave behind, how much I'd have to give up, what I would have to start over. And I kind of imagined Joshua kind of, like, standing on a cliff, and God saying, all you gotta do is jump, and I'll take care of the rest of things. Not even saying, like, I'll catch you, but saying, I will take care of whatever happens. So I started thinking about that, I guess, a little bit more, and how that maybe would apply to my life. And I really saw very clearly that God was saying, you know, you're on a cliff, and I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen when you jump off the cliff, but I'm telling you that you can trust me because I'm asking you to jump. That was it. But I think that was the moment when I realized that God was asking me to shed myself of my everything that I built up, my whole life that maybe I created for myself, and start over from scratch and have a life that was completely dedicated to serving Him. I also had this apartment, this problem with my apartment. It was a really expensive apartment. And my parents were helping me pay for it, and if I was going to move, that my financial situation would change. And I had it in there for a whole nother lease, and a whole nother year. The lease was for a whole nother year. And I didn't really want to ask you know, the girls at Longview did not let me pay, you know, for a whole year or whatever. And even if they didn't, I still wouldn't be able to afford it. It was too much. I went to God and I was like, all right, you told me that this is what I should do, and you said you'd take care of it. So, but I knew that, you know, I had a responsibility, and I started making flyers, and I was trying to see if anybody wanted to, you know, get the lease from me, like sublet or something like that, you know. And I called my landlord, and she was like, there's no way that I will be able to find anybody. Nobody wants to rent this time of year. They've already gotten their leases, because it was like late June, early July. I was just completely devastated, and I was so scared. And it might not seem like that big of a deal, but piled on with all the other things I was nervous about, I was just like, oh my God, I can't handle this. This is too scary. This is too crazy. 2 days later, my landlord called me, and she's like, oh my God, someone called me and said they really need a single apartment, like just like yours. So I'm just giving it to them. You don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to pay another cent. I was like, okay. The retreat was like literally 3 years ago, like right around now. Since then, like I look back at, I guess the last 3 years then since that decision, and I can, this is gonna sound cliche, I suppose, but I can honestly say that that's when my life really started, or I finally learned about the idea of being a disciple of Christ and living your life completely for the Lord in a radical way. There's just no other way for me to live. I can't imagine any other way to live. And so when I look back at that, it's like, that's when my life began. It has not been the easiest 3 years of my life at all, because making a decision to follow God doesn't mean that you're going to be spared from all of life's ailments. It doesn't mean that all your decisions are going to become easier, and it doesn't mean that that it's not going to be hard even just to try to do that, you know? But I know now that I have something I didn't have before, and that's a purpose to live, which is what I ask God for. And I can't imagine a more amazing answer to prayer. I said, you give me a purpose to live, you let me die. The last 3 years, he's answered that prayer times like infinity and shown me that there really is a purpose to live, and he has an incredible purpose for me. The last 3 years of my life are the best I've ever lived, and I hope that the rest of my life just continues to be even more and more and more of learning how to live even more radically for him, because I think it's the answer. Like, I didn't know what the answer was before. I thought it was love, I thought it was all these things, I thought it was school, music, prestige, but it's not, it's following God. When I look back on the decision, I try to weigh, like, was it worth it, you know, or was it the right decision? It's just like, yeah, you know, yeah, this is the best decision I've ever made in my life.
You take my hand now, take your hand, baby.
Well, there's a lot she didn't mention, like the way that God's already used her to impact the lives of dozens of people. Now she teaches the scriptures to a whole group of women. And that's, I think, just the beginning probably of a life that's going to be super well lived. Did she make the right decision to try to follow God? Or was that a big mistake? Well, I guess that just depends on the value you place on the things of this world compared to the values you place on the spiritual values having to do with God. And I agree with her. I made a decision similar to that myself. I've never regretted it. All of my friends that went the other way are full of regrets today. And it's painful sometimes to sit with these guys now in their 50s talking about how rotten their life has been and how awful and everything has gone wrong and stuff like that. And just sit there and just realize, I'm basically happy. I mean, I'm just so glad that I staked my life on God. And you make these huge, life-changing decisions at your age, a lot of them. Well, let's wrap this up. Just to make sure that we've applied this personally. Are you sure enough about who God is and what the future holds to follow Him with radical trust? That's really the question here, isn't it? Is God real? Because if He is, then He is the one that we need to come to terms with. He's the one we need to reckon with. And He's our future. That's where all of it goes. You know, where is this all headed? It's headed toward God. So if He's real, then that is big enough to get behind with your whole life. Or Or are you just going to take your chances with what the world system has to offer? A lot of people make that decision, and I'm not talking about people that aren't Christians here. I'm talking about a lot of people who are Christians decide, I'm just going to try to find that middle ground, you know, I don't want to get carried away. And so they go and pitch their tents near Sodom. I think we need to face this, whether you're going to prepare to tell God tonight that you are prepared to follow Him completely. Some people call this the second decision. The decision that I'm not just going to be like a Christian believer for what's in it for me, but where I'm going to give myself over and I'm going to become a radical follower of Christ. Other people, some of my friends may decide not to do it. I don't care what they decide. I'm making my decision right here, right now. You can make a decision like that anytime you want, but it's binding. It's an important decision. Shouldn't be made lightly. And I would just urge you, do it. Trust God utterly and give yourself completely to Him. If you don't want to do that, think about what Jesus said. Luke 17:28, He says, as it was in the days of Sodom, so shall it be when the Son of Man is revealed. There's going to be a lot of similarity, I guess, between what was going down in Sodom and the way we're headed in the last days before the coming of God. And then He throws this comment in. Remember Lot's wife. Oh. Why are we supposed to think about her? Well, I don't know. I'll let you ponder that one. Anyway, next week, we're going to study this incident that I think is the most astonishing example of living faith in Abraham's whole story. It's an unbelievable story of the extremes that he took. We'll take that up next week. All right. Why don't we just turn to God for a while together? Lord, we know that if we're going to follow You, that there has to be trust. And there's just no way around that. We can't be second-guessing You all the time and still think we're going to move ahead with You. So this is really what it's all about here, God. I pray tonight for an opening of the eyes for all of us, that we can see the grossness of mediocrity, how absurd it would be to think of following God halfway. That is so absurd, Lord. We should banish that thought from our minds. And I pray, God, for the fearlessness and the boldness that comes from real trust in You, just to be able to commit our lives into Your hands in the full knowledge that You are truly a loving Father, and that if You call on us to follow in a certain way, that's because it's for our best. No other reason than that. And we are skeptical, God. We do doubt. We doubt sometimes that anyone could be that good. And yet, You are. We need an opening of the eyes, God, to see that. And we pray for that tonight. In Christ's name. Amen.